This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Marvel Age podcast featuring the Sarcastic Four, episode 4, 1965.
I loved the series, but after Jack and I did the first few, I don't remember how many, 4, 5, 10, I don't know. We both got busy with other things, and I had to drop something. Right. And the reason I dropped the X-Men, and Jack went off it, not because we thought it was less of a strip, but there were so many characters, it took a little longer to write.
Place to Be Nation Pop, welcome back to the Marvel Age podcast, your year-by-year journey through Marvel's entire publishing history, beginning with 1961, all the way up to present day, theoretically, at some point. Maybe. We'll see. I, of course, am Nick Duke. I am your host of this wonderful show. Alongside me, I have the Sarcastic Four, starting with the man himself, Mr. Tim Capel. Tim, how are you doing this fine, undetermined evening?
Oh, Nicholas, you are a remarkable female, and I am so glad that everyone is joining us here again for this edition of Monsters to Laugh With.
Well done, sir. Well done. I don't know if I can do any deep cuts that well myself, but the man who probably can, the West Coast contingent, Todd Weber. Todd, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing spectacularly well. It's a wonderful evening here in sunny California, and I'm looking forward to talking more about 1965 with the three of you. Absolutely.
All right. A very NPR-esque answer from Todd Weber. Russell, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing pretty well. We had an interesting beginning, and I can't really add anything better than what these two assholes have said, so let's just roll with it.
Let's do it, man. If you've listened to the podcast before, you know kind of how this works. We have some reading lists out there for you. If you want to get those reading lists, just send us a line at the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page or hit any of us up on Twitter. We'll give you all that social media information at the end of the show. But we are culling through each year of the Marvel Universe using the wonderful comicbookherald.com. A guy by the name of Dave Busing put all that together. And that site specializes in reading lists, specifically, well, for the purposes of this project, something called My Marvelous Year. And the goal here is to distill down the 10 most important stories from each year of Marvel's publishing history. As we have discovered, guys, as we've gone along through this, story doesn't necessarily mean issue. And that is the reason that tonight's podcast is not 1965. Oh no, it's 1965 Part 1. I think we all knew that there was a point coming in this project where these years were going to start to become unwieldy and we were going to have to start splitting them up into multiple episodes. I have to say, me, myself, I did not expect it to come this early. Were any of you guys as surprised by this turn of events so early on in our show as I was?
No one ever expects it to come that early.
Well, there you are. Rousing response from the panel here. But no, in all seriousness, we are going to split this this year up. And so for tonight's discussion, we're going to be talking to you about 1965 in the pages of Fantastic Four, Daredevil, and Uncanny X-Men. So guys, to start off, let's start like we have our previous podcast, kind of talking about where you were coming into this year, what you were looking to get out of it. Russell, we'll start with you. What were you expecting from those three titles here into 1965?
Well, kind of expecting Fantastic Four to continue on the same trajectory that it's been on for a while now, which is just being its weird, sometimes enjoyable, most of the time eye-rolling self. Daredevil, I was expecting, you know, with the debut of the red suit, things were going to maybe get a little bit more gritty, start to feel a little bit more like familiar Daredevil. And I got to say, the ones I was really looking forward to most were the X-Men issues, because that's when we were going to start diving into a real change for that group. A very big part of their identity is going to finally be introduced, as well as a major villain who was actually one of the first villains I ever knew of the X-Men. But now, looking at this, I get to see where this all started. So, had some some, you know, moderately high hopes for where this is going to go, and looking forward to talking about those issues specifically.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same boat you were as it relates to the X-Men, although I think we're talking about different concepts here, because anybody who has listened to me talk about X-Men on the, in Hard Traveling Fanboys knows that my initial exposure came through the X-Men animated series. And so I was looking forward to the introduction of, while not a particular villain, a particular villainous concept that we're going to get to talk about here in 1965 in the back half of this show. But as we talk about the X-Men, you know, no better place to go than Tim Capel. Tim, what were you looking for out of this reading list? What were your expectations coming into the first part of 1965?
Yeah, pretty similar to that. Looking forward to an increased emphasis on some X-Men reading, which we do get in this year. A little bit surprising to me that as much X-Men, Silver Age X-Men in particular, as it did, has made the reading list. I think even if folks are not super familiar with X-Men comics of the 1960s, if anything, they know they are a far cry from the X-Men that most people are more familiar with. But it is nice to see them get some shine this year. Beyond that, we talked about how at the end of 64, we had really laid the foundations of what the Marvel superhero universe was going to look like, and we're there now. You know, while we do have some introductions coming up, they are largely villains and supporting characters. We don't have any new kind of major solo protagonists introduced this year, so we're really off and running. And with that foundation in place, I'm kind of looking forward to Marvel settling into that groove as more of a well-oiled machine, with Stan Lee working with his sort of repertory player of artists at this stage.
Absolutely. Todd, what about you? I know you've been a little bit higher on the Fantastic Four stuff than some of us. I'm close to there with you. But were you looking for Fantastic Four to continue to be the top interest getter from you?
Yeah, I was. We look back and people talk about these first 10 years or first 100 issues of Fantastic Four and how every year just got a little bit more intense, a little bit more influential. And so I was looking forward to this long-held legendary wedding issue that we have between Reed and Sue coming up this year. And I specifically remember reading about it in Marvels, the Kurt Busiek, Alex Ross masterwork that's just one of my favorite comics of all time. And so I wanted to see it through the original lens. It's, again, an issue I've never read. And in fact, none of the whatever 15 issues or so from the first half of 65 were comics I'd ever read before, even though a lot of the stuff in X-Men that we're going to cover, I'd kind of read about in Marvel Universe, the handbooks that told you about the origins of the characters and the powers of the characters, their histories. So yeah, I've never read any of these comics, even though I owned them in Essential Marvels and the Black and Whites, but had never really bothered to read them. I kind of didn't start reading a Fantastic Four until the Galactus stuff.
Okay.
So, yeah. So I was looking forward to checking those out.
That's interesting. I think this is the first episode of this podcast where I actually had a little bit more prior knowledge than you, because while I hadn't read most of these issues, I had read the two Daredevil issues prior to this. I had gone through a pretty, not a deep dive, but I read through probably the first like 6 or 7 years of Daredevil right after the Netflix show hit and got, you know, super into that. So anyway, with all that being said, let's go ahead and dive right in, guys, to the material we're going to cover here during this first part of 1965. And let's start where we have started every show to date, and that's with the Fantastic Four. Todd, you just talked about it. You know, we're expecting big things from the Four this year, and we start this year's reading list with Fantastic Four 36 that sees the introduction of the Frightful Four. That, of course, being Medusa, the Wizard, Sandman, and our old favorite, Paste Pot Pete. You know,
useless from day one.
Well, you said it, Russell. You know, I got to say, I've been higher on Fantastic Four generally than I think you have, Russell, to this point. But yeah, this is one where I can't, man, rough to say the least. What were your general impressions of this one, and kind of what it added to the Fantastic Four mythos?
Not a whole hell of a lot. Taking a Spider-Man villain, or traditionally Spider-Man villain, with a Sandman, and putting him with the Wizard, who is, you'll be forgiven if your response to that is, who? and Pastepot Pete, who, as I just said, useless from the moment he debuted.
Now, luckily, they would rename him in subsequent issues, which we'll talk about here in a little bit.
Yeah, very unfortunate rendering of his abilities. But then there's, you know, we got to find that fourth member, as the wizard likes to put it. It's like, we got to find a female member. But why has it got to be a female? Because, you know, apparently if you got a dick, they don't necessarily want you. But yeah, the introduction of Medusa is probably the most notable thing from this issue, because she is going to play a big part in a future well-known, if not necessarily well-beloved, Marvel group. Mm-hmm. So, but of course, introducing her as a villain here puts her in the same position as many other Marvel characters that would eventually turn babyface, as we will see later.
And that's one thing that I kind of wanted to get the panel's reaction to. You know, if you guys have listened to the latest episode of Marvel Age Masterclass, our sister show with the fantastic and just so well-spoken Mr. Ben Morris, he recently had Todd Weber on as his guest to talk a little 1964. And one of the things that Ben was talking about on that show was, by this time, by the end of 64 into 65, you're starting to see a little bit more long-term planning. But here's one area where I'm going to kind of call a little bullshit. I am of the belief, just reading this, that the Medusa Inhumans thing was in no way planned from the get-go. It feels very retcon-y. It feels very sudden change of direction to me. And am I the only one who felt that way? Todd, I'm going to ask you first, because you're a little bit more up on the Silver Age Marvel than I am.
Well, it's like Ben was talking about, and he says it's almost apologetic the way he talks about these things. Stan set up these gifts for later writers, where he left so much of the canvas blank that you could fill it in later. So whereas they didn't have that long-term plan from the beginning for Medusa, I think it was they were able to say, well, we have this visually strong female character. Let's build an entire concept around her. And, you know, I don't think they had that from the get-go at 36, but this is way, you know, almost a whole year later, the end of the year, when we are introduced to the royal family of Atalan, the Inhumans that we were going to get to talk a little bit more about. But in 36, we had the engagement party, which was kind of the highlight of the issue for me. That was kind of my favorite part, just because you had all three of Marvel's big teams, X-Men, Avengers, and Fantastic Four, drawn on one giant panel. And every character has their own little moment. It's pretty cute.
So here's another area where I have to question the reading list, and maybe you guys can fill this in for me. Does the engagement itself actually take place on panel, or does it take place off page? Anybody know?
I think it happened before. We don't see them actually propose by the beginning of this. Oh, well, I guess I haven't read the issues before, because I'm buried with all these other ones to keep up with.
Right. That's what I was wondering, is if we missed something here, if, like, we didn't see it. And I would think if it had happened on page, it probably would have been on the reading list, but I don't know. Anyway, you know, quibbles with the reading list aside, Tim, what were your reactions to this one? It does give us the Frightful Four, but I don't know, man. Doesn't give much else for me.
Yes, the extremely purple clad Frightful Four.
I'm glad you brought that up. The Sandman design on the cover. I was like,
purple,
wait,
Sandman.
What is this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So, I don't know. I somewhat admire the effort in trying to repurpose Sandman as a Fantastic Four villain. He is a little bit more powerful in some respects than other members of Spider-Man's Rogues Gallery, with, you know, their physical mutations and what have you. So, you know, there's some work being put in there to kind of put him on a bigger playing field. These guys are very committed to their gimmick of cementing themselves as the Fantastic Four's opposite number.
Yes.
And the creators are really committed to the gimmick as well. We see them debut here. They're going to keep coming back around over and over throughout this year and in subsequent years. While they are not the most impressive visually or powers wise or as characters or in a lot of ways. There's an effort, and I don't know, I kind of like it. It does somewhat make the FF themselves look like buffoons for, you know, having these guys get one over on them as much as they do. But I don't know, it's all right for what it is. But Doctor Doom, they are not. I'm surprised it took them this long to do the whole, oh, we have the Fantastic Four, now we have the villain version of the Fantastic Four. I mean, we're 36 issues in. That's, you know, that's really three plus, over 3 years. Mm-hmm. This has not always been a monthly series. So that surprised me a little bit.
Yeah, that is mildly surprising, especially because you consider, you know, as we talked last time, our last episode about the Uncanny X-Men, the X-Men had the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants very early on, whereas you don't really have that analog for the Fantastic Four. Not to
Bendis
delve
had Masters of Evil too.
There so. You go, exactly. Yeah. And not to delve too heavily into the plot of this one, but was I the only one who thought the method of the Wizard joining up with this group was absolutely hilarious? Where the FF had just left him to theoretically like drift into space and suffocate and die. And the Sandman and Paste Pot Pete just happened to like bump into him on an airplane as they're making this jail escape. That whole sequence, I was like, this is extremely convenient. And if I'm being honest, a little fucked up from the Fantastic Four, is it not?
Almost as much as his unfortunate costume.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are some bad costumes here. Let's just call it what it is.
It's a bit phallic, yeah. if we're being honest, complete with purple head.
Absolutely.
Well, keep in mind, he's the wingless wizard.
Yes. So, dear God.
Yes. All right.
This is not the most well thought out issue.
I have a quick hot take. I'm sorry, not to step on. This is very quick. And Todd, I want to get back to you. The Yancey Street Gang.
Yeah, that's one thing we haven't really talked about much on this show yet. But it's something that has kind of been a recurring. You know, we haven't seen them and we haven't had them take on any active role in plot yet, but it's been something that has come up over and over again in dialogue. So, Tim, go ahead.
I just want to say, is this me or anyone else? They are maybe just one step up for me from the Teen Brigade in terms of just how much I cannot be bothered to care.
Okay, so for me, they haven't popped up in the actual plots of any of these books we've read so far. So they haven't had the chance or the opportunity to royally piss me off the way the Teen Brigade has. So I'm kind of ambivalent towards them, is the best way I can put it.
Okay.
Todd, I think you had a point you were gonna bring up.
I just enjoyed all the floating people in this issue. Everybody's floating.
They were flying on Air Claire, to say the least. So, in any event. Moving on in Fantastic Four, we also read for this year Fantastic Four 37. And whereas 36 leaves you off with a cliffhanger where the Frightful Four somehow mysteriously escape, you would think, hey, 37 is going to pick that plot thread up. Nope. 37 takes you full on cosmic, and it takes you out into the far reaches of space through a wormhole and all the way to the Skrull homeworld. You know, bringing full circle a lot of plot elements that have played out both in issues we've read for this project and issues we haven't. So this is kind of the first example. You know, guys, when I think about the Fantastic Four, I kind of always associate them with being, like, somewhat cosmic. They're not full-on Guardians of the Galaxy. They're not out there with the Nova Corps or anything. But I always kind of think of them as having this cosmic bend to them. And this is really the first opportunity we get to see that as part of this project. Quality-wise, you know, it's okay. But I think I dug this one more for its concepts than necessarily its plotting or its dialogue here. Tim, I know you have talked about the hilarity of the Skrulls, specifically as it relates to the Skrulls being barnyard animals back in episode 1, I believe it was. So what were your impressions here as we take our first look at the Skrull homeworld?
Well, I take it the Skrull homeworld and the Skrulls have reappeared prior to this, just in an issue we did not cover.
Yeah, I think there was a footnote that said that they had been in 4 issues up to this point, and we've only read the one, so 3 issues that we have not seen. Yeah, which is a great point, because I think part of the plot of this issue is talking about Susan and Johnny Storm's dad being killed by a Skrull, which we did not read for this project. So that was interesting. A good point out on your part.
Yeah, so the motivation, they're going to the Skrull homeworld to avenge the death of the elder, Mr. Storm, because Susan's feeling bad about how they, I guess, left that thread hanging. So we have the father of the invisible girl slash woman and the Human Torch, having been killed by aliens, joining the ranks of Professor Van Dyne, the Wasp's father, mm-hmm. who was killed by a random alien.
Good call.
And I kind of want to track this a little bit to see if this is going to continue throughout our readings. You know, while the plot leaves a bit to be desired, I do really admire the art in this mm-hmm. issue. It's one of those, you see Kirby getting a chance to cut loose, you know, the Kirby tech. And Todd, maybe you can help me out here. Is that a Zipitone effect on that big splash page where they're like soaring through the cosmos? They're in subspace, I think, is what they refer to it as.
It's as though they superimpose a photograph or put the Kirby art onto a photograph. And we see that a couple other times throughout this list where there's just one big page and it's the money shot, so to speak, where you have just something you haven't seen in comics before, almost a mixed media. And although I don't know if it's Zipitone in general, I associate that word with John Byrne's kind of stuff that he did with the Namor series back in the 80s or 90s. But
I do too, but this looks like that to me, kind of.
Well, if you thought the wizard's costume was phallic, that spaceship is really dongish.
I'm looking at it right now. You want to talk about the money shot.
All the barriers it goes through.
It is definitely very very Dr. Evil-esque in that regard, you know, with the giant – or no, it's Austin's ship. Excuse me. I hate to misquote my Austin Powers references, but yeah. Like you said, that art technique, I don't know what you would call it. You guys had the term – that was stunning, and we start to see it a few more times here throughout Fantastic Four issues. I thought that was amazing. Russell, what was your take on this one? I, you know, like I said, I thought this was at least better than the Frightful Four issue.
Certainly. Big step up from the previous issue, and it was cool to see like all these plot threads that have been weaved into the Fantastic Four kind of coming to a head here. I was a little taken aback by Sue Storm's sudden need for revenge. I felt like that was really out of character.
Yeah.
So it was bugging me the entire time. And one thing I do have to note, well, I haven't gone back to read the other encounters with the Skrulls, but it always seems like every one of them seems to end with it being like the last time. This is the last time you're ever going to see the Skrulls. But of course, come on, you know they're coming back.
Yeah.
I will say, though, that Thing continues to be my absolute joy in reading these issues. Every time he's on panel, I'm just loving everything he's doing. He's my guy now. And
Russell, did you catch the bit where he comments on his own lackluster sound effect after their powers have been released?
Yes, that was great.
Yes. And of course the I actually kind of got a little more emotionally invested in this issue than I expected to, especially with the part where it seems like Reed has kind of turned heel or turned on the team and is helping the villain of this issue actually conquer the Skrull homeworld. And as it turns out, no, the plan was actually to use this specialized ray to restore the lost powers of the Fantastic Four so they could combat them. Pretty clever on his part, but the way he goes about it, I stand by my statement probably now and forever that Reed Richards is a dick. And this issue did nothing to counter that. But great Kirby art, lot of fun watching Thing wreck shop once he gets his powers back. And yeah, I wound up having fun by the end of this one.
Yeah, that's one thing that we haven't touched on really. This issue kind of starts to play with this recurring motif that we'll see pop up a couple of times throughout 1965 of the Fantastic Four kind of inexplicably losing their powers. They will try to explain it away at various points with some sort of pseudoscience, but it seems to happen far too often for it to just be like a recurring coincidence of some sort. So I thought that was odd as well. Todd, you know, this one, you talked about the art stylings a little bit, but what were some of your larger impressions on this one? Were you taken with the Kirby designs of the Skrull homeworld? Because I know I was.
I didn't enjoy this issue very much.
Really? Okay.
I didn't. I think it's kind of a Skrulls are just like everyone else kind of story for me.
Yes. Another one of those allegories at the end. Yep.
Yes. But I think the only thing I can do, Russell, to explain Sue's suddening for revenge is she's getting married. She's very sad that her father won't walk her down the aisle. That's it. So
there you go.
The issue itself, again, that trope of they lose their quote-unquote natural powers, right, which are artificial or cosmic ray induced anyway. But, yeah, the first Fantastic Four issues I ever read were they were stuck in the negative zone during John Byrne's run, and that was a long – felt like an eternity, a long, long arc against Annihilus. And so this kind of reminded me of that where – they were interstellar travelers. Of course, you know, we hadn't even made it to the goddamn moon at this point. But, but they're going across, you know, the other side of course, the spherical universe, as Einstein postulated. Look at all the science we're learning here. And on the other end of the universe, as you pop out of the circle, is the Skrull Galaxy. How about that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was just all right for me, dog. I keep saying that. I like certain things about it. I do like the Thing as a character. He's still the highlight for me, like Russell. He's the funniest. And just the little things that he says under his breath that you you know they were dying throwing those in. That stuff would just kind of send you over the edge when it's not, you know, it doesn't really serve the larger story, but it gives Thing more of a moment. It was fine. It almost felt like a fill-in issue to me. It was so off track from all the other things they were doing, with the exception of the wedding rehearsal thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just kind of came out of nowhere, apart from the other threads that had been going on. I felt we had a kind of a cliffhanger with the Frightful Four last issue, and then all of a sudden, no, we've got to take care of this thing on the other side of the galaxy.
Which is especially weird because the Frightful Four get followed up on in issue 38, which was not on our list. So it's a little bit of a weird quirk here, I think. It almost makes me wonder if they hadn't originally intended to do the story of 38 in 37 and move 37 to 30. I don't know, but one of those things.
If you flipped this issue and the previous issue, would it have flowed a little bit better? Maybe there was a production delay because of that crazy Jack Kirby page.
That's a great point that I didn't even I didn't even think about. So, yeah, I think we've talked these two issues pretty extensively. So let's move on. Let's go from the Skrull homeworld and shrink it all the way back down to the streets of, I guess, not really Hell's Kitchen at this point. I don't know when the kitchen would actually become an active part of Daredevil's story, but we're still here early in Daredevil's mythos with Daredevil 7 and 8. And let's talk about 7 first, guys, as this sees the return to the city of New York of Namor the Submariner. We last talked about him on this podcast in Fantastic Four Annual Number 1, talking about a big deal. Or I guess, no, we have seen him since then because he popped up in Avengers. Good, I misspeak on my part. So this was a little weird, though, to see a character like Daredevil, who had kind of been portrayed to this point as more street level, going up against Namor, who had kind of been presented as this massive threat given his role in big-time Fantastic Four stories and his overarching presence in the Marvel Universe at this point. That being said, as weird as it was, I still wound up really enjoying issue 7. I thought the art was outstanding, even if they are still trying to find that Matt Murdock voice. And like Russell alluded to, good to see the red suit here. Russell, I know the red suit probably popped you as big as it did me.
It did. Seeing this be the first appearance of that suit, I was all in. I was like, finally, this is the suit that's going to be around for pretty much the duration of Daredevil's existence. Mm-hmm. They nailed the look very early on. Hopefully the yellow suit never to be seen again. And as you just pointed out, the artwork on this is phenomenal. Wally Wood is way ahead of his time. This might be the best looking issue we've seen yet.
It'd be up there.
Everything.
Yeah.
As soon as I hit page one, I was struck by his ability to craft a scene, and it only gets better from there. So many good points just for art on that in this issue alone. I mean, it's less cartoonish than Fantastic Four or even Amazing Spider-Man, which I would actually say has been one of the best, probably the best looking book overall up to this point. I mean, this guy's giving Steve Ditko a run for his money. I will say I'm with you that it was weird seeing Namor in a Daredevil issue, and that the whole lawsuit subplot's kind of lost on me. I thought that was just really dumb.
To throw out there what Russell's talking about, Namor's plan in this issue is actually to legally win his right to conquer the Earth in the court of law. So a little bit out there.
Sue the entire human race.
Yes.
Yes, he wants to sue the entire human race using United States law, to which the offices of Nelson and Murdoch are just completely taken aback. They have no idea how to react to this. But the real plan is that one of Namor's generals has been seeding this idea and pushing it on Namor to get him to go back to the surface world so that he could kind of stage a coup over Atlantis, which was part of the issue that I kind of dug. I was thinking this sounds more like something that might actually happen and provides a little bit of bit more of a push of Namor back to being more of a hero character, at least far less villainous than he has been. And it seems like every time we see him, he becomes less and less of a villain. He's becoming much more of a sympathetic anti-hero at this point. And this was a little bit of an odd pairing, but overall it was not unenjoyable as an issue.
Yeah, I absolutely would agree with a lot of that. Bizarre plot aside, how did this one play for you, Todd?
This was kind of an epic. Mm-hmm. this was a very dense issue. I read very differently than the other issues of Daredevil that we've read so far. Everything is framed legally. Wally Wood's art is spectacular. I've never seen anything like that in this era. Closest thing I could maybe compare it to was the Bill Robinson, who did the Daredevil number one we read a year ago. Bill Everett, there it is. I knew it was Bill. I was going to say Jerry Robinson. That's a different artist. Anyway, I like this issue quite a bit. It was kind of weird seeing Namor out of his element in the courtroom. No pointy ears to be found, but they made lots of references to his ankle wings. Enjoyed all the interplay between he and Daredevil. Daredevil is really kind of pushing his limits, never giving up in this fight. And you'll see that again in a later Daredevil appearance in 1965. But this issue itself, pretty darn good and definitely a Marvel milestone. That cover is one you do see thrown about quite a bit over the years is kind of like an example of great stuff that happened in the Silver Age.
I do got to ask, Todd, you may have a different perspective on this than I do, but did it weird you out at all that the police actually wanted Daredevil's help at several points in this issue and that nobody was shooting at him or trying to get him out of police or military business? It was like, hey, there's a costumed hero here. Great, come and help us out.
Yeah, that's not not the police we're used to seeing maybe in comics these days or even in the world these days. But no, I don't know. Maybe they're trying to downplay. This is the era of the comics code. You didn't want bullets and shooting and unnecessary violence, although
sure.
Namor's tried to kill the entire city several times.
Just the fact that they're working with him. Another thing that Namor hates the surface world, but the one thing I think he hates more than anything else in this issue, doors. Doors and windows. Fuck all of them.
Elevators especially. Man, that elevator pissed him off.
I kind of took his destruction of a couple of different revolving doors as a foreshadowing for Namor's feelings on the concept of the revolving door of death in Marvel Comics later on. Hmm. Marvel, he don't do revolving doors.
Gotcha. It is weird that this depicts Namor as if he has like zero familiarity with surface world customs, but I mean, it does make for some fun sight gags, at least. You're right.
I mean, he could just use the door when leaving Nelson and Murdoch's office, but nah, fuck that. Crash through the window, crash through the whole wall. Just, you know, give him a new window.
Yeah, absolutely. Tim, did you have anything else to add on this one before we move on?
Just to echo pretty much what has been said, this is another one that I had mentioned, the trade paperback from the 70s that I somehow possessed as a child, Marvel's Greatest Superhero Battles. This one was reprinted in that as well, so first read this story many, many, many years ago, liked it then and really like it now. And Todd is right that this becomes a little bit of an understated epic, if that makes any sense. While Namor's motivation is kind of a howler, it's utterly ridiculous, it pays off in some genuinely tense and pretty inspired action scenes. And I would argue that Daredevil gets the biggest win over Namor that any hero who has tackled him to date has really been able to achieve. He doesn't just drive him back. He really wins his respect.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it especially feels weird considering you've got this epic battle blazing out on the streets of New York. And I'm like, where are the Fantastic Four right now? You know, like they have the most experience with Namor. Shouldn't they be, you know, responding to this scene at some point? But no, Daredevil
kind of.
Well,
they were clearly on the Skrull homeworld.
There you go. Or off on some island with the Frightful Four or whatnot. So there you go.
They were selecting a China pattern.
Bachelor party was actually this day.
Yeah. It is too bad that Wally Wood does not stick around too long as artist on this series. Mm-hmm. And this is something we talked about over and over, right? That the art just seems to keep getting better on Daredevil, of all things.
You know, I could make the argument that I think the art across the board continues to get better. I mean, even Jack Kirby in the pages of Fantastic Four, like, I don't know that he's necessarily getting better with his pencils, but look at some of the innovative art types like you guys called out a little while ago. The layouts are becoming more. We're starting to see more use of full-page art as opposed to panel by panel. We're starting to vary those layouts. I think visually the books are starting to really evolve in terms of ways they can tell their story instead of feeling so formulaic at times. But
and Kirby may have a reduced workload at this point too. If you read X-Men, which he was previously the sole artist on or the sole penciler, mm-hmm. the later issues of X-Men that we're going to get into in a few minutes, he's not doing that. He's just doing breakdowns, so doing mm-hmm. very quick sketches, and then another penciler will come in and finish. So maybe he's got more time to devote to books like the Avengers and the Fantastic Four at this point than he did in 61, 62, 63, 64.
Good call there, Todd. Before we leave Daredevil behind, though, let's talk about one more issue that, you know, did not play for me as well as the Namor issue did. That's for sure. And it deals with the introduction of a Daredevil villain that, guys, like, even as a kid, when I would, you know, look page through in, you know, Marvel encyclopedias and stuff, or, hell, even as a teenager when I would do the same, can somebody explain to me what the appeal of fucking Stiltman is? Todd, defend this goofy Silver Age shit.
There was an unhealthy fascination with getting high.
I guess, but...
Oh, my Lord.
Jesus Christ. Tim, anything here?
I think this made the list for ironic reasons, I would suggest. Okay, Stiltman, you know what Stiltman is like? He's like that mid-level video game boss that really you should be able to get past pretty handily, but for some reason you just can't crack that nut. You know, it's just like, why is this giving me so much trouble? And that's what Daredevil's struggle in this issue is. It's like, it's fucking Stiltman, as you put it. And somehow, for some reason, Daredevil just cannot, for the life of him, topple this guy. So, I guess the whole swerve with the client that approaches and Murdoch.
That was going to be the only thing I could call out is the swerve and the identity. But other than that, I mean, man.
There's something to that, maybe.
Russell, anything?
Glad you called out the swerve, but if I may, there's a scene very, very close to the beginning of this where Stiltman in his first appearance and his first like robbery is telling these, I guess they're armed guards transporting money via helicopter as he has stilted his way up to them and is instructing them to hand it over. Of course, they're not cooperating. They're shooting at him. And his response is, if you'll permit me.
I expected you to try that. And then you'll show them I'm not to be trifled with.
Read him as Bane, and it is incredibly entertaining.
This may need a revisit.
I guess. I'm sure we haven't seen the last of this fucker, so I'm sure I'll have an opportunity in the future.
Hang on.
But I will say this is the most entertaining Stiltman issue that I had ever seen up until Mark Waid's like little one-offs that he did during his run, which I will defend as being pretty good, overall funny, and actually kind of linked together to form their own little mini arc as it goes along. So Stiltman, not the greatest villain, and certainly laughable whenever you look at him. But I'm telling you guys, if you read him as Tom Hardy's Bane, it makes it so incredibly funny that it makes the issue tolerable.
I just don't understand why he would be a threat to Daredevil, like, at all. It makes no sense to me. I don't know. Is there anything else we need to say about this goofy horse shit?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
I have the first line of my Randy Orton, Cody Rhodes legacy prison lovers fanfic.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be, oddly enough, the first line of this comic, which is, keep screaming. Don't stop. Don't stop screaming.
Oh, God.
Great line from the first page of this comic.
Yep. Read that same way. I read it in a similar fashion, Tim, and I giggled for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then I was able to move on with the rest of the issue.
Very good.
Todd, anything else you want to throw in here on Stiltman?
Not on Stiltman, but the end of the issue has some pretty fun hijinks between Matt and Karen, because
yes.
Matt knows that she will never love him because he's a blind person.
Because blind people can't be loved.
There's a lot of I can't be loved sentiment going around the Marvel Universe at this time. You know, the thing up for the longest time until he met Alicia Masters thought he couldn't be loved because of his appearance. The lame Donald Blake thinks he can't be loved because he has to use a cane. Matt Murdock thinks he can't be loved because he's blind. Scott Summers thinks he can't be loved because, you know, he has a mutant power that affects his eyes. There's a whole lot of woe is me sentiment as it relates to romance, coursing through the veins of the Marvel U at this point. But
she calls him a coward here. I mean,
she does.
This is the man without fear. How ironic is that? And she's not even crying.
Very good. And the thing is, they frame it as the idea of this sighted woman and this blind man being in a relationship is presented as being so unthinkable and revolting. It's just like, wow, the Silver Age sure was a thing.
It sure was. But moving on from Daredevil, leaving him behind for 1965, that was the only two issues on our Daredevil, two issues of Daredevil on our reading list for this episode. Let's hop over to the pages of X-Men. And let's talk about X-Men 12 and 13. And we'll talk about these both at the same time because they kind of tell, or not kind of, they definitely tell one cohesive story. You can put those together as one story. And this story sees not just the debut of classic X-Men villain the Juggernaut, but also the reveal of his origin and how it relates to Professor Xavier. Real quickly, you know, because I want to get to Tim on this one and Russell as well, because I know that you guys both have deep connections to this. I was blown away by this. I'd never read it before. Honestly, I always liked the Juggernaut from a visual standpoint, but never really got into him too much as a character. And while this origin is simplistic, it's a simplistic origin that absolutely works and makes him pretty damn compelling, I have to say. And it doesn't hurt that I know we talked about the fact that it was Jack Kirby layouts. I can't remember the name of the penciler off the top of my head. Anybody
who Alex Toth on the first one.
There you go. You have that at your fingertips, I figure.
Very, very good.
I thought the action scenes here were outstanding. Tim, talk to us about some Juggernaut here.
Yeah, so we get one of the maybe the most notable debut of this year, or maybe something else coming up in X-Men. Mm-hmm. Either way, Juggernaut, super iconic X-Men villain. I like the way that they handle this, where it's kind of like a, I don't know, it's like a movie monster build to his full reveal throughout the issue. And they're sort of interspersing within just that tension, all these flashbacks from Professor X. This is also, believe it or not, where we get the reveal of his first name as Charles.
Oh, okay. Didn't even pick up on that.
12 issues in, you know, we learn that his name is Charles. I mean, you do kind of, there are moments where you kind of wish it's like, okay, pick up the pace, Chuck, and we get the fucking Cliff's Notes version. What are you doing here? But, I mean, just from the standpoint of drip-feeding this information, it is pretty cool. I definitely appreciate the, we'll call it little acknowledged fact of Xavier's athletic prowess as a kid. You know, it sort of dispels that notion that I think a lot of people have of him as being that sickly, sort of put-upon child, but he was, in fact, running circles around his stepbrother in basically every way. He was not really the victim in this scenario. Largely, he was just indifferent to this guy, and that's where all of Kane Marco's resentment really stems. He was kind of a surly individual in the first place, and then you put him in this situation, and that jealousy just begins to stew, and you know, you see how he comes out the other side, for the worse, having received the power that he does. So it's pretty cool the way this story is told, and it kind of subverts your expectations.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, it's almost interesting to look at this origin in the context of how we've seen Professor Xavier act up to this point in X-Men. We talked about him just kind of randomly taking off, and he's always had this little bit of a secretive bend to him, and this almost feels like the reveal of one of his deepest, darkest secrets, that being his half-brother. Russell, I know you were alluding to being a big fan of the Juggernaut, you know, recognizing him as one of your favorite X-Men villains. How did you like revisiting this origin here?
This is, like you were pointing out earlier, Nick, this is a pretty simplistic origin overall, but actually this is not the one I was referring to. The one I was referring to was the one we're going to get to later.
Gotcha. Me as well.
However, I do really like the Juggernaut as a villain. I think he's one of the most compelling villains that the X-Men have, mostly because of his connection to Professor Xavier. And as the other guys mentioned, Alex Toth's art, this is another guy combined with Jack Kirby's layouts. Just, this is a tremendous looking issue. One that, despite Professor X's How I Met Your Monster story that he decides to just drop into, you know, giant unstoppable force coming to kill us. Let me tell you a story, children. That seems to be his approach. That is a unique situation. However, Kane Marco is pretty well done as a villain in this. I mean, he's no Magneto or anything, but he is a more than solid villain. You kind of feel a little bit of sympathy for him because he doesn't understand that his stepbrother has like mutant abilities as they're growing up. He just thinks that this is a guy who's just better than him at everything, and it drives him more than a little insane. I will say though that even though I thought the dropping into the flashback story was a little ill-timed considering what your team is about to be up against there, Professor, still it wound up being a good story. I wound up like getting pretty emotionally invested in the childhood and the plight of one Charles Xavier. But it still bears repeating that the way Juggernaut comes into actual existence is pretty ham-fisted and weird. But up to that point, good stuff, and the battle in next issue is actually where it really hits for me.
Yeah, I would agree with that as well. It's definitely clear that that Stan loves you know, weird cave origins, whether it's Iron Man in a cave or Donald Blake in a cave or, you know, Kane Marco in a cave. There's a lot of caves going on around here. Todd?
Yes, I think that Professor X also lost the use of his legs in a cave.
There you go. Caves are bad places to be or good places to be, depending in the Marvel Universe. Todd, how'd this one play for you?
Well, I'm not going to go anywhere with the cave allegory or metaphor, but this issue was interesting because I'm not going to because Stan Lee is apparently a friend of a friend. So we are going to talk about how every couple pages. We've got more time. Let me tell you this. We've got more time. He's not here yet. I've got time to tell this story. I loved little boy Xavier too. Yes. With his round Charlie Brown head and he still had the crazy eyebrows. So the eyebrows were a thing back then, but we get to know, his stepdad here, and this is stuff that's covered very well in X-Men Grand Design. If you've read that, I believe it's Ed Piskor is the writer artist on that, where he kind of puts the X-Men saga in a big, easy to follow chronological format, and so this is told when it happens and not in the middle of this approaching Juggernaut. Love the build to the Juggernaut too, because even though you see him a little bit on the cover, you don't see the character himself till the very, very last panel. It just gets big, and it's almost like Doomsday is coming. You know, the same kind of feel that you had. So, yeah, this issue 12 is fantastic in its own way. Definitely, you see the Alex Toth faces. I don't know if you've ever seen what he did as a designer for DC in the 70s. He designed all the Super Friends stuff. He did a lot of random short stories for DC and Enemy Ace and comics like that. Very good artist, but he was not here very Space long Ghost at all. Space Ghost. That's right. Yeah.
If this issue looks a little Hanna-Barbera-y, that's probably why.
Johnny Quest.
Yep.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, I love how you get the slow reveal of Juggernaut, but it took me out of it. Literally, it took me out of the story when Xavier takes you out of the story to tell the story of he and his stepbrother's relationship. And there's some weird coloring stuff with red faces. Apparently, the Marcos have a red face condition.
Gotcha. That was interesting. That was interesting. But you talk about that last page reveal, and that's a great way to just segue right into issue 13, because that last page reveal, we get to see, you know, we have talked about on these airwaves, you know, during this podcast, about how some costumes are works in progress and some costumes they spring fully formed. And this is one that springs fully formed. The Juggernaut costume design is one that just works. Even in 1965, it works for that character. And when you get that last page reveal, I dug it. And so then in issue 13, we get a lot more of that costume as we see the X-Men actually enacting their plan to try and take the Juggernaut down. And it's pretty much just constant go, go, go action in this issue. And I wound up just really enjoying the hell out of it. Todd, I'm assuming that perhaps this one played a little bit better for you since you didn't have the constant in and out with the origin story.
Well, actually, I preferred 12 to this, although this was still fun. This was very straight ahead.
Yeah.
You had the art was a little bit more conventional, and that is why I think I preferred the other issue. Mm-hmm. Although you do have the debut, at least for me, of Joe Sinnott as an inker, and he's one of my favorite classic inkers. I mean, this issue is drawn in kind of a timeless way. It could be a 70s issue. It could be an early 80s issue because Sinnott had that line work where he was working on Avengers all the way into the mid-80s, late-80s. But the actual kind of takedown of the Juggernaut where I couldn't follow where they decided that getting the helmet off would – I missed that information where the helmet must be the only vulnerability he has. It felt like Xavier knew that all the whole time.
Yeah, Xavier tries to attack him using his powers, and he says to Xavier, "You're not going to be able to do anything to me as long as I have my protective helmet." And then that kind of becomes like, "Hey, well, if we get the helmet off, you know, that whole chestnut."
Okay.
Yeah, I think that Xavier thought that he could not attack him mentally at all, and then Juggernaut kind of tips his hand by saying, "Well, really, it's just the helmet." And so, I mean, Stan Lee is being perhaps a little bit coy and not completely telegraphing that, but I think it does kind of serve the story that it was like, oh, okay, so that's how they're going to take him down.
Mm-hmm. Tim, what did you think of this one, the wrap-up to this two-part story?
So I will say that while the Juggernaut design is very strong, seeing him in metal underwear is a little bit jarring. He does not have the full leggings yet that he will and that we will more commonly associate with the character, but that's fine. This issue 13 is penciled by Warner Roth, who he's actually more of a DC artist, but moonlighting under the pseudonym of Jay Gavin here, because he didn't want to get caught by his editors at DC. So it's really just Toth, who did the one issue, and it's going to be Warner Roth who sticks around for a while here, especially going into the next arc we're going to look at in this series. But anyway, all that aside, there is one very cool bit about the Juggernaut and his characterization and his power that I don't know really gets followed up on. Maybe has been kind of lost to time, but it's mentioned that he's kind of like exuding force from his aura, as if it's he's this creature of perpetual motion. Uh-huh. And it's like taking a conscious effort for him to just stand still. I thought that was very neat.
That is a cool power that I really wish they had that more people would use with him.
Yeah, I mean, they talk about the unstoppable Juggernaut, right? But the idea that he literally can't stop except to put effort into it is something that kind of goes unexplored.
Yeah, it's like the kinetic energy of his motion that's like keeps building up in him, and he's mm-hmm. going to like he can unleash it as like as his own form of projectile weapon. I agree with you. That was a really cool thing.
Yeah, we get a guest star in the Human Torch here. feels a little bit random. But, it's all right. You appreciate these little touches in early Marvel comics of characters weaving in and out of other series. So
thanks for chance stopping to by, plug Johnny. The annual. That's what it was.
Yeah. Yep. There you go. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, but thanks for stopping by, Johnny. And by the way, before you leave, you're not going to remember any of this.
Yeah, great. Great stuff. Yeah.
Nice. How did I get all the way out here?
Xavier was not allowed to link himself to the X-Men officially at this point.
Yeah, that was...
And so kept having to... I don't work with them. I don't know who they are. Really, that's not mine. It's not my bag, baby.
he's not even out as a mutant. He's like a genetics researcher, I guess. But he is not out as a mutant and not publicly affiliated with the X-Men that is sort of important to know.
And speaking of Professor X, that's one thing we should mention, is that it's another plot thread that's kind of we don't see on these reading lists, because last time out when we talked, Professor X just up and leaves. He's gone. And he leaves Scott Summers in charge. And by the time we come back to them in issue 12 here in 1965, Professor X is back at the mansion. He's running the team again, and he has taken that burden off of Scott's shoulders. So
he had to go to the pleasure planet of Ryza.
Oh, good. Very good.
All right.
That was just a little head game he was playing with that whole deal.
He was just fucking with Cyclops, essentially.
We did have Nurse Maid Jean Grey in this issue.
Oh. Yeah, we did.
Yeah, the one little awkward bit there at the end.
Yeah. The Beast trying to get him a little kiss.
She's not his mother. I did want to point out that I thought some of the action choreography in this issue was really good. And one particular thing that I don't know why I love it so much, but it's something that sticks with me. At one point when they're trying to slow down Juggernaut in the mansion, Cyclops actually blasts a giant hole in mm-hmm. the ground, like through the mansion, and traps Juggernaut in it. Mm-hmm. Juggernaut's way of getting out is to punch his own hand and foot holes as he's climbing up, and Cyclops sees him doing this and just starts bearing down on him with the optic blast. Well, Juggernaut starts digging a deeper hole underneath the floor and slides his way into that, and Cyclops can't see this happening because of his own optic blast. And what Juggernaut does is he digs a hole directly under Cyclops and bursts up through the floor. which is I'm imagining this happening. Like, if you film this as like a movie or TV scene or something, and just the visual of that happening, I thought that was really cool. It was just something that
classic Kirby, you know, kind of seeing it from a bird's eye view and develop it. You could see that in some of the other books too, a similar kind of action scene. But yeah, I thought so too, Russell. That was really kind of unique, and I enjoyed Juggernaut being inventive that way.
And every X-Man has a use in this issue. Nobody comes off as just like you're just here to take up space. They actually each throw their best shot at Juggernaut, and they do a tandem and team offense to try and take him down too, which is something that I also really appreciated about this, that it wasn't just each hero attacks individually. They actually started using their powers in tandem, and that I thought was really inventive and a lot of fun to read.
Well said. Well said. Well, with that, all that being said, guys, we're actually going to take a break here. And when we come back on the other side of the break, we're going to talk more X-Men, but we're also going to talk a whole lot more Fantastic Four in 1965. So stick with us through the break. We will be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place for Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceForNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place for Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcasts, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talking Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans
with the hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlaceForNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceForNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceForNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, listeners, to the Marvel Age podcast. This episode covering part one of 1965 in the Marvel Universe. Here in the second half, we are going to dive back into some X-Men and especially take a little bit of a deeper dive into the first family of Marvel and what they were up to in 1965. So with that being said, let's dive right in here and talk about Fantastic Four 39 and 40. These two issues were on our list, and they tell something of a two-part story that involved the Fantastic Four losing their powers. And while they could have spent these two issues just dealing strictly with the FF trying to find a way to get their powers back, they kind of do something interesting in that they explore the idea of the Fantastic Four knowing that them losing their powers is a danger to the world because it could, you know, inspire criminals and supervillains to come out and, you know, attack now that they know that the FF are powerless. And so we get to see them trying to artificially recreate their powers using various forms of science and stuff like that. And of course, eventually Dr. Doom shows up to take over the Baxter Building, and it's up to the Fantastic Four with a little bit of help from their kind lawyer, Matt Murdock, to try and win the Baxter Building back. So we'll just talk about 39 and 40 together here since they flow into one another. Guys, gotta say, I was extremely impressed by this. The entire concept of the FF not really just devoting all their efforts to getting their powers back, but to saying, okay, what can we do to actually protect people in the meantime while we figure this out? That's a small touch, but it's a very, very important one that says a lot about where the Fantastic Four as characters were at this point. And then, of course, all the Doctor Doom stuff, throwing in Daredevil as we get the, you know, continue to see the interconnectivity of the Marvel Universe. I was just a big fan of both of these issues. Tim, what did you make of this little two-part story?
What I took from this is that Daredevil is getting somewhat of a big push here in 1965.
That's a great point.
Saw earlier, he gets that moral victory mm-hmm. over the Submariner. He survives the menace of the Stilt Man. And here he's playing the role of guest star who really takes over the book, you know, with the Fantastic Four having lost their powers, somewhat vulnerable, needing someone to lead them. And they get a lot of mileage out of that metaphor as the blind man mm-hmm. leading them, of course. So that's pretty cool. And by the way, how much shit does he have crammed into that billy club? It's like a utility belt, you know, somewhat Batman-esque. Here we see...
was this the issue we got the diagram of his cane, or was that actually in the pages of Daredevil?
That was in Daredevil. I think it was in the Stilt Man issue where we got the cross section of the Billy Club and all the gadgetry.
I know we dumped on Daredevil 8, but that was actually pretty cool. Like getting to see how all that ties together and how it works, trying to at least put some pseudoscience to it.
Right here, I'm not sure whether it's 39 or 40. I think it's issue 40. We see him use it like a shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
Taking out some of the contraptions that Dr. Doom is hurling at the team. So he can use it as a shotgun. We've seen that it has gas pellets that can be deployed. He can use it as a recording device.
Mm-hmm.
It's referred to as a snooper scope in one of his issues where he's like spying on people and, you know, getting the sound waves amplified through mm-hmm. his horns, which double as antennae. So lots of like little touches with Daredevil throughout his own book in this one. I know I'm talking a lot about Daredevil in a Fantastic Four series of issues here, but I guess that's because I don't have a ton to say about them and their involvement in their own story here.
But you're right. It definitely feels like Daredevil is being thrust to the forefront of the Marvel Universe very early on in this tenure. It makes you wonder if there's not something about that character and that concept that Stan Lee was a big fan of.
Maybe so, yeah. I mean, they didn't give up on him. To Ben Morse's point on one of the Marvel Age Masterclass editions, you know, Stan was pretty reluctant to call it a day on any of his early creations. So mm-hmm. while they were struggling behind the scenes a bit with production problems and changes in artists on Daredevil's solo series, I don't know that it was really lighting up the sales charts either. They're really sticking with and they're committed to getting that character over. He's got the rocket strapped to his ass, you know, getting that push. So I'm a fan, definitely. What else here? We have the issue 39 picking up after the team making their harrowing escape from The Frightful Four, that was an issue 38, not on our reading list, but I kind of skimmed it. Brought back the Frightful Four. You get a battle with them. And the team has lost their powers after a massive explosion. They get rescued. So it's kind of cool seeing them rather morose and not wanting to state the obvious until they ultimately have to. And it's sort of fun seeing the artificial recreation of their powers that Reed is exploring too. Some cool sight gags there. So we get Dr. Doom coming back, making his big play. Didn't think this was the greatest usage of Doom, but it does play into his ego and the idea that, you know, he's not going to just directly attack his adversaries. He has to, you know, toy with them, you know, that psychological warfare that we see him wage so often with this group. So on that level, it does work. But, yeah, I didn't totally love this two-parter. But, you know, there is some value to it for sure.
Yeah, what about you, Todd?
Stan, this is Martin, your cousin Martin. Listen, Daredevil's not selling very well. We need you to push it a little bit in the big book. Can you do that for me? So this was, I don't know where this episode of Early Marvel Bullpen Theater brought to you by by Melanzas.
Yeah. Now, if we're going to have
Pabst Blue Ribbon, I think.
If we're going to have Todd with some theater, I think that voice is going to have to be a little bit different, a little bit something that we would know perhaps from the airwaves of CNN.
Call up Martin Goodman here. Stan Lieber, what a truly great missives writer you are. We need you to take care of Daredevil and get him so he's selling more than a couple thousand copies per month. Can you do that? Also, change his costume. The yellow is just terrible. I'll take your call off the air. So this was an interesting issue with Daredevil being shown to be kind of a leader, kind of a guy who can punch up and fight outside of his level, you'd expect. And, you know, it's not like Dr. Doom pulled the Namor and saying, I respect you. I'm going to go away. You're a valiant opponent. Here it's just Doom being a dick and taking the Fantastic Four's gear and using it against him. The issue for me, though, is memorable with all these ways that Reed is trying to fake and copy their powers externally and with the other devices, and the dick move of trying to fool blind Matt Murdock with fake powers was kind of indicative of what's going on with Reed's ego at this point. Now this is kind of the danger of them being public, right? For them having their identities exposed. If they were, say, a Spider-Man or, you know, a character with an alter ego that was not known to the public and they lost their powers, they could just kind of vanish for a while and somebody else would step up. So I don't think we talk about that as much as this notion of they're in the public eye, they're celebrities. Mm-hmm. And so they feel the pressure to maintain that. But they got to that point awfully fast. You know, it's like, we don't have our powers. Okay, next page. Here we go. I've got these things ready made almost. Here's this animatronic thing that you're going to control, Ben. Mm-hmm. And, if those suits worked at all.
Right. Reed puts so much effort into recreating their powers when the solution is right there in front of him and does get explored later in the issues. I do appreciate they pay some lip service to the idea of why didn't he use this?
It was recharging.
Yeah. No, it was recharging. It just needed a few days. Why didn't you just wait a few days? Fuck it.
I just said that here.
You were a complete asshole to all of us by being a real dick about this whole thing and just freaking out about giving us our powers back. And this whole time, you could have just said that this thing just needs to recharge and we'll be okay again. Fuck you, Reed.
Well, and in 440, he really is a dick to Ben. He's like, nope, you have no choice in the matter.
No. Oh, he's a complete asshole through both of these issues. And here's the fucked up part. He can be a complete ass to everybody, and they'll still praise him as the best guy ever. Because they do, right after it happens. Robert Kirkman, did you base Rick Grimes on Reed Richards? I just got to know. That's that was irritating. My favorite part of it, though, was Doom.
Yeah, Doom was great.
Except for the Daredevil stuff. The Daredevil out of his league against Doom in the 40 was my favorite part.
Well, yeah, that's what I mean, like the inclusion of Doom. But my favorite scene with Doom is whenever we first see him in 39, and this magician who's trying to, I guess, put on a little show for him, and Doom is just so woefully unimpressed by him. He's like, eh, whatever. He's like, I'm going to give you one last chance to impress me before I have you executed. And he's like, oh, well, I'll try this hypnosis trick. And he's like, wait a minute, you've already been hypnotized. You're hypnotized right now.
Yep.
He's like, what? He's like, I'll just remove it. And this is a callback to Fantastic Four Annual number 2. Mm-hmm. Dr. Doom, this whole time, has been under the impression that he defeated Reed Richards and the Fantastic Four. And as he even says later in this, I believe it's in issue 40, when he says that once he's defeated Reed Richards and the Fantastic Four, he's going to take – his next move is going to be to take over the world. And I'm just like, bullshit, man. You're going to be bored because you had that opportunity before when you thought you defeated Reed Richards and the Fantastic Four. And what did you do? You went back, built yourself this little throne here with DD on the back of it, and you put on, like, have magicians put on little stupid shows for you. You had no interest in it. Like, come on, man. If it's not for Reed Richards, you're going to sit on your ass and do nothing. That's the real truth of it. He needs Reed Richards to motivate him, and that is exactly what happens here. And I got to say, I did not realize his mask was so malleable, I guess, because he has a real, like, gasp take with it in the mouth, like, opens wide. So I'm just cackling to myself over this metal mask being able to, like, form actual human emotions. And he's so pissed off he has suffered this indignity of being hypnotized this whole time. So, I actually did find this to be a pretty good couple of issues. Mm-hmm. I found the Fantastic Four to be far more compelling without their powers than with. And if they want to give Daredevil the big old push out front at this point, I'm for it. Let him have it.
Yep. I did think it was interesting that we actually, you know, we kind of talked about how 37 didn't really add much, you know, issue 37 didn't really add much to our reading list except for the Skrull homeworld, but I guess they kind of, you kind of have to have that to establish the Deus Ex Machina they use at the end, that little device to get us all out of it. So
one little weird thing about the reading order here, at the end of 40, Thing quits the Fantastic Four.
Yep.
And and when we pick up again with this team, we skip definitely several issues because we go into Fantastic Four Annual number 3 mm-hmm. coming up, and Thing has rejoined the team. So apparently his leaving, at least as far as the reading order goes, is not really that important of a thing, if you will. I'm assuming that maybe it even gets resolved in the very next issue.
Yeah, that's what I was assuming, but I wasn't sure.
Well, what happens here is this is an actually, I guess, maybe, but it isn't all that important, ultimately, and I do see why that little stretch of issues was left out. The Thing walking off at the end of issue 40 is kind of cool as an earned moment because, Reed doesn't exactly come out of this looking like the best person, to say the least. It kind of plays into his ego as much as Doom's, where it's not enough for him to defeat Dr. Doom. He has to really stick it to him by having his best friend best him physically, so much is made of that. So he's forcibly transformed Ben Grimm back into the Thing and pretty much used him as his bitch against Dr. Doom. So that was one of those moments where it's like, we criticized the Thing's behavior in the early issues of this series where it just felt like he was kind of being a dick and you weren't getting any real insight into his kind of inner turmoil in his world and what's going on in his head. Here you really do, and it feels like a much more natural extension of the character.
Glad you put it that way, because Reed really needed, one of his best friends to kind of put it to him that he's being a real dick and that has consequences. And Ben Grimm is the perfect person to do that.
And so over the course of the next three issues, he actually gets brainwashed by the Frightful Four. Yes, they're back. And used against the team, but not a whole lot of consequence there. Ultimately, they defeat the Frightful Four, get Ben back, and all is forgiven. You know how it goes.
Yep.
So, and that, and I guess it's in those issues where the Frightful Four wind up imprisoned.
All but Medusa.
All yes. except for Medusa, yes, because that's kind of an important plot point going into the annual.
Right.
Excellent. And as you mentioned the annual, let's dive right into the annual, because this is one, guys, that I was especially looking forward to this year. And it's because it touches on something that has kind of been a bone I've had to pick with modern comics companies and creators for a while now. And that is the narrative that's out there that people don't want to read about married characters. They don't want to read, you know, about our heroes being in committed relationships. It's just not interesting. Well, I would say that look all the way back to 1965 with the most popular characters in all of comics, arguably at this point, or at least for the most for the hottest publishing company in 1965, which was Marvel Comics. And here we are, you know, under a little over 3 years in, doing a wedding. Having a marriage, making a big deal of it. And I point to it and go, if it worked then, why can't it work now? So this one was something I was looking forward to digging into for those reasons, but also after reading it, it's just a hell of a lot of fun. It touches across everything across the Marvel Universe. Every character, every villain, everybody you've ever seen just about pops up here in this issue. It is cameo galore, and yet it winds up being a damn entertaining read, complete with the greatest cameo of them all at the very end in Stan and Jack reappearing in the pages of Fantastic Four. So, Todd, I know this one probably means a lot to you, so I'll let you give some thoughts on it.
Yeah. not too dissimilar from what you said. Every page has a different comeback. I love how the X-Men are, again, kind of treated as almost equals to the Fantastic Four here. I have a point about the marriage that we'll talk about in a second, but it was still a lot of fun to see all these crossovers. It was kind of like the Spider-Man annual last year, where you had storyline reasons and brief touches of these characters, and they all get their little moment to shine. You also had almost the entire Rogues Gallery of the Fantastic Four coming out of the woodwork, all the way back to the Mole Man. You didn't have Molecule Man or El Diablo or characters like that. You even had the Mandarin randomly showing up, Kang, the Gray Gargoyle, the awesome android from the Mad Thinker, the Super Skrull. Look at all these crazy characters you had going through.
The Hatemonger.
Did you have the Hatemonger? I may have missed that.
I think
don't forget Tim's absolute favorite, Red Ghost and his Super Apes.
Super yes. Apes. Yep. Thank you. Yeah, the immaterial Red Ghost feasting in and out. All kinds of stuff. You got a great Thor story, Thor moment. We got Captain America interacting with the Fantastic Four. We got to see the Executioner from Ragnarok and the Enchantress. The Enchantress and all these great characters, not just from Fantastic Four, but rogues galleries from other characters like Daredevil and Ant-Man and kind of the whole Marvel U. We get to see Hawkeye's first appearance as a hero. So I have to take...
Quicksilver's too.
Quicksilver and Wanda are in this too, so this did happen after Avengers 16. I don't know where it lined up in the calendar, so they had that.
Yeah, so
planning to happen.
Definitely more interesting version of Nick Fury.
Yeah, so just to talk about how the sausage is made here a little bit, with us splitting these reading lists up into two parts now and covering 1965 in two parts, we kind of pushed all the Fantastic Four to keep it together in one episode. So we're actually going to see some things here in this annual, like Nick Fury in the modern context being an agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., like Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch being Avengers, and like Hawkeye turning face, some things that we won't actually talk about in depth until our next episode, which will cover the rest of 1965. So that's kind of where we are with that.
We also saw the Watcher come back, and because he has pledged not to interfere in anything, he interferes again by providing Reed Richards with just the right weapon for this. Well, I can't point it out to you, but there may be something here you're allowed to take. I mean, what a crock of crap it is to have the Watcher do this. Or maybe that's just the way he's always been. And we point that out, you know, how ridiculous he is. But classic issue, Nick Fury, again, you're seeing a lot of that character mixed in with the classic Marvels. He's on security duty here. It's pretty cool. Classic all time. They also had two full length reprints in this annual, which are not reprinted in Marvel Unlimited, but still pretty great.
Yeah. Certainly.
The main story was only 25 pages. So.
Yeah, but I think we've done that before with the other annuals. I believe, except when I can't say that, though, because I know the Namor story in Annual 1 was huge. But I think the ultimate victory of Dr. Doom or whatever, the main Dr. Doom story in Annual 2 was probably around 25 pages, pretty close to that. But anyway, certainly a landmark issue. Tim, I think you were about to jump in right there with a point.
Well, that is a good point, is that we're accustomed to the lead story in these annuals being a little bit longer, and this one was, you know, just a little bit over 20 pages, which is kind of your standard story length. And it sounds crazy, but if anything, I could have gone for more pages with this one. Just because there is so much packed in here, you could get a lot more out of it. And the story, the plot itself is not terribly deep. There's not a lot of stakes here, even though you've got a ton of characters fighting. It's just sort of a big kind of superhero mashup and kind of celebration of where Marvel has been and where it's come to at this point. So I appreciate it a lot from that standpoint. I did not know how much I needed things like the X-Men beating the shit out of Mole Man and the Moloids until I saw it. Thor versus the Super Skrull. Again, if we'd gotten more pages, I would have loved to seen just that fight, you know, on its own. Daredevil versus Hydra. More of that Daredevil being out of his element on a, like, runaway truck bomb, which gets a pretty hilariously awesome payoff. He crashes it into the bay just as the Atlanteans are surfacing, blows them up. You know, you talk about Cap and Hawkeye and going up against some of these B-list villains, plus the Enchantress and Executioner, of course. Angel fighting the villainous Black Knight in the sky. Just so much going on here that, you know, could deserve almost an issue or like a subplot in its own right, because it's so much fun. We've got sexy beefcake Watcher in his toga doing the whole, "Hey guys, I'm a Watu."
Yeah, baby New Year.
Yes, baby New Year. That's right. Playing so fast and loose with his oath as he often does. I just, again, there's not a ton to sink your teeth into plot wise, but it's so much fun. This is an example of an issue loaded with cameos that it's really done right, because they're all here for a reason. You don't know exactly who you're going to see, but it's mm-hmm. expected that it's going to be a load of characters. And by the way, it doesn't matter that much that some of them are acting out of character because of the whole, you know, sort of hand-waving mind control element to this. So this is just delightful. I love this annual.
Russell, what about you? I think everybody else has been pretty effusive in their praise this far.
I'm going to be right there with them. This was a lot of fun. This was, you know, I know it's a Fantastic Four annual, but this might as well just be a Marvel Universe book, because the only two characters who don't appear in this thing are Namor and the Hulk. Mm-hmm. Everybody else is here. Doctor Strange even gets a minor moment where he removes Tim's favorites
and
from
to
the story.
To your point, though, about Namor and the Hulk, don't we even have, like, editor's notes explaining yes. why they're not here? Because yeah. these two yeah. have taken over co-starring in Tales to Astonish backup, or not backup features, but anthology stories. Each yes. one of them getting their own story in that page, in those pages now.
And I love that Tim brought up Angel and the Black Knight having an aerial battle, which I thought was one of the coolest sequences of the book. When Thor shows up, though, he steals the scene. Thor versus Super Skrull would have been a hell of a lot of fun. And even Daredevil taking on Hydra was cool, but I really dug the idea of Captain America versus Scourge and the Enchantress. Spider-Man didn't warrant an invitation to this wedding, apparently, but he still shows up in time to save Hawkeye. He's like, and there's your one. Everybody gets one.
You know what was it's interesting when we think about this issue. If this was done in a modern context, they probably would have made the actual Fantastic Four part of it like a 3 or 4 part story, and all these little fights would have gotten their own like $5 one shots, and we would have had like it would have cost you like $75 in comics to read this entire story if you really wanted to.
It's true, and I think this presentation of it is better for those purposes. But this was a whole lot of fun to read. Seeing the entire pantheon of the Marvel Universe truly come together here. I'm right there with Tim on X-Men versus the Mole Man and his Moloids. Seeing them like wreck shop over them was a lot of fun. I would actually read an entire issue of that if they were to give it to me. Mostly because seeing Mole Man get beat up is fun. It just is. You agree with me on that, Tim, right?
Like, yes, very much.
It's just so much fun to watch him get his ass kicked.
It shouldn't be, but
it is. The only thing that might be more fun is watching Thing punt him like a football. That could be fun too. But yeah, everybody gets a moment to shine here. We get this one panel that I really love with everybody just going at it. The big brawl is happening, and you've got. It looks like Thor is yelling, "Avengers assemble," and you've got Thing on the other side with his hand around, I believe that Scourge's neck, saying it's clobbering time. And like, you know what? And Johnny Storm right up above them calling flame on. It is such a fun issue. There are so many good just like action-packed moments. And I mean, as dense an issue as this is, it really moves. It is fast-paced. You won't ever be bored. One of the most fun times I've had reading Fantastic Four, because I've kind of resigned myself to being the one on this group who just is probably never going to get on board with them. But this issue, you could not help but have fun reading it. And it was one of my favorite points of 1965 so far.
It really is almost like a perfect distillation of what the Marvel Universe is at this point, because you get all these characters and all these concepts, and you get just enough of them that if you were going to hand somebody, you know, one book and say, this is Marvel in 1965, it would probably be this one, I would argue. So
yeah, I would say, like, hand this to somebody who wants to see where Marvel was at this point, this will do it. This is a great cross-section of everything that was going on at the time. And from here, you can just kind of – it's almost like DC Universe Rebirth number one. You get a good cross-section of everything that's happening at the time, and you can just pick which of these stories you want to go forward with. Which of these characters, which of these teams is most interesting to you? Go get their book after this.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's leave the Fantastic Four alone for a moment. Let's leave them right here, and we'll pick back up with them in just a bit. But let's hop back over to the pages of X-Men, because while we saw the debut of Juggernaut in issues 12 and 13 – here in issues 14 through 16, we have a three-part story involving the debut of what I would argue is right behind Magneto and perhaps, you know, Mr. Sinister or Apocalypse, one of the more classic X-Men villainous concepts, and that, of course, being the Sentinels. Now, while these are not yet the Sentinels as we would come to know them as, you know, robots who could detect mutants and were tasked to hunt them down, the concept is still here in its formative stages. You have the Bolivar Trask aspect of it. You have Professor Xavier becoming aware for the first time that, oh man, now there's going to be a public campaign against mutants, and he understands what this means for both his people and, of course, his school and his students. So, Tim, as I usually do with these X-Men issues, I'm going to start with you. I wound up really, really enjoying these, even if, you know, they aren't necessarily the versions of the Sentinels that I have come to know and love. You can still see the building blocks here. What was your take on this one?
About the same. Now, before we go too heavy, because this is kind of a heavy arc with a lot to unpack. Try to keep things light here by calling out. So there's a bondage scene between Iceman and Angel
yep.
in issue 14.
Yep.
I wonder what Uatu, the one who likes to watch, his commentary on this whole exchange would be. I will say that the line, "Make them tighter, Bobby," that's going to be the opening of my Lashley Lesnar slash fic. So try to work that in. But no, I mean, beyond that, we see this is an example of how X-Men was a little bit leaning into the soap opera. Even back then, there's some interpersonal dynamics explored here. Mm-hmm. And it is more layered than sort of that bullshitty office romance stuff that you got in things such as Iron Man and Daredevil, right? Where, yeah, kind of everybody has the hots for Jean, sure. But they've cooled off on that a bit. We're seeing more of a friendship between Iceman and Beast. Angel kind of thinks he's dating Jean, but she doesn't really have eyes for him. And, you know, you talked about how Scott is that typical kind of lovelorn leading man Marvel hero where he feels like he can never make this romantic connection because blah, blah, blah reasons. But this does a really good job of driving home the point that Cyclops really feels like an outsider, even among his own people. Whether he should or not is a question for another day, but he does. You know, when everyone goes off, when Professor X kind of dismisses them for a little R&R, everyone has a place to go except for Scott. He's only really any good when he's at the forefront of this team leading them in battle. Left to his own devices, he's just sort of lost. So these were some touches I really appreciated just in terms of the characterization. Now, getting to the Sentinels, they are like a distillation of anti-mutant hysteria, right? Mm-hmm. We're now cranking that up to 11 here. And I don't know, it's like the risk of amassing this army of mindless, soulless, perhaps fascist automatons is that, you know, one day they might start to think for themselves and they might decide that they can enact your vision and your ideas a lot better than you. And that's what their creator, Bolivar Trask, finds out for himself. Uh-huh. And there is a part of me, I guess I should stress, that looks at this and wants to say, how big of an asshole must a person be to look at any sort of policy that's so wildly inhumane and as what Trask is proposing here and just plain wrong? And you're only going to be bothered by it by asking the question, well, how might that be bad for me? Mm-hmm. You know, but this is a framing device that it's certainly not unique to Stan Lee and not unique to 60s comics. So you sort of take your wins where you can get them. I would say this is the most political Stan has gotten
yes.
in his writing
and
that we've seen so
and
far.
And that's something I wanted to bring up, especially to get you and Todd's thoughts on it, because I know you guys have delved so deeply into the pages of X-Men, as you can hear on Conversation Comics. I think there's a narrative out there amongst comics fans, and especially those who have something of a blind spot for early X-Men. And I think the narrative goes something like this. The X-Men, as we know and understand them, didn't really exist until Giant Size X-Men number one and everything that came after. I have to say that reading these early X-Men stories, guys, the building blocks are kind of there from the get-go. This whole narrative of the X-Men not really being anything like what the X-Men would become until much later, not really holding water for me at this point. Am I the only one who's kind of seeing it this way?
Nope. I'm right there with you. This is, you see that anti-mutant hysteria kicks mm-hmm. in really fast. As soon as Trask starts talking about it, it's hitting the news. It's all over the newspapers, and Professor X calls it right that suddenly everybody goes just absolutely nuts over mutants. And like that scene, if you'll recall, I don't remember which issue it is exactly, but Cyclops is trying to get to the professor.
Yeah, it's in 14.
After his alert goes out. And the taxi driver takes a curve too fast, and Cyclops' glasses come off. Mm. And when that happens, he shoots a hole through the roof of the taxi cab. I mean, it's pure accident. He's getting his glasses back on, but all anybody around him sees at that point is, there's a mutant, get him. And that's the kind of hysteria that, you know, I think Stan was tapped into. And I find it really interesting that we're reading this now, especially since we all now live in the age of the quote unquote fake news. And that was something that was happening here. It was something that, the media was playing a part of in this story, where people were just like their worst fears and instincts were being played on. And back to your point, this is absolutely the most political I think that Stan has gotten up to now, and it certainly is not going to be the last time, because the building blocks of what would be that ongoing arc of the mutant menace and mutant hysteria is going to be a big factor going forward with the X-Men as a whole.
I am glad you mentioned the media, Russell, because that's a sort of minor element to this, but something that I picked up on as well is they're depicted as sensationalizing current events, sort of
yes.
in pursuit of profits or ratings. You had, you know, Bolivar Trask, this kind of charismatic figure who's made an appeal to emotion, and he is, you know, stoking the fear and paranoia within the public to further his agenda. And we see that these things, they almost always trump measured fact-based appeals to reason, pun intended there. We see Professor X going on the defensive immediately, but it's kind of falling on deaf ears. So important stuff here, and being recognized and seized upon by one Stan Lee.
So let me
–
go ahead.
I was just going to say that it's interesting that I remember as I was reading Professor X's initial reaction to Bolivar Trask, like spouting off at the mouth, I kind of looked at Trask like, well, who the hell is this dude? Like, he's just going on television spouting nonsense. Is anybody really going to believe a word he says? And then I started to realize, wait a minute, Professor X's like alarmist reaction might have actually been the right one here. And my reaction of nobody can possibly take this blowhard seriously was proven to be the absolute wrong one, because here he is actually appealing to these folks and getting through to them, because he's speaking to their baser instincts. He's speaking to what appeals to them most, and that's their fear. Mm-hmm. And
not to get too far off topic, but I want to ask you, why do you think that narrative about X-Men not really taking off as a concept until Giant Size X-Men number one is out there? Because I'm just seeing too many similarities here in these early pages to really buy that anymore.
Yeah, I think part of it is revisionist history, because, well, they were all white before Giant Size X-Men.
Gotcha.
So, you know, we're going to be an allegory, but we're not going to be a literal representation of something different. We're just going to put this in this corner. But if you frame this in the
diversity without representation,
literally, and I mean, until you, I guess with Lorna and her green hair, you got a
yes. There you go.
Know, we got a goth. If you go to the era this was in, this was the year of the Birmingham church bombing. Mm-hmm. This was all the a lot of the civil rights movement was really picking up steam and was on everybody's mind post-Kennedy, post kind of the recovery of the country with LBJ and the mid-60s. Things are kind of back to normal. Vietnam's gearing up. But you had this kind of nameless, faceless threat that Trask is talking about. And so the media picks up on that and they make grotesque mutant representations in their drawings, sensationalist. And of course, all the X-Men can kind of pass for human. None of them are really freaks at all. But without the explanation, the public goes crazy for them. I mean, they turn on Cyclops right away. Why aren't they turning on somebody like Spider-Man? We know they're not turning on the Fantastic Four. They're kind of public figures who are out there. But how do people know, or why do they just assume about the Fantastic Four? Also, why can't the Sentinels pick up that Professor X is a mutant? I mean,
Do they actually mention in this story that the Sentinels can detect mutants, or simply that they are, you know, ordered by Trask to eliminate mutants who have been identified? Because I think
when Warren is flying, oh, there's a mutant, I've got to get it. You know, I think that was maybe just a response to his power.
Because that was
seeing that he was an anomaly flying.
Right. That was one thing I don't recall seeing it. And you guys, please tell me if I'm wrong. I don't remember them ever actually saying, hey, these Sentinels can detect the mutant gene or detect mutants.
Yeah. Artificial intelligence that can have independent thought and turn against its creator is fine, but let's not go too far and let them be able to detect genetics and DNA.
Well, and the other thing is the Fantastic Four we've talked about are very public heroes. They're kind of an open book in a way that the X-Men aren't. They are a little bit more clandestine. They are a little bit more secretive and do tend to freak people out just by the nature of their powers and their appearances, perhaps. And I thought it was smart to play up the idea and just to get across the idea that, I mean, it does it totally work? Not really, but they at least acknowledge that, okay, mutants are different from other superpowered individuals because they have this genetic difference, and so they're trying to subjugate the human race in a way that enhanced humans such as the Fantastic Four would not be. It's very much kind of as Russell was talking about, othering them as this kind of subspecies almost. It's pretty gross, but effective in some ways, and I'm glad that Stan had the insight to at least make that attempt, even if it isn't perfect because of the existence of, you know, these other superpowered characters in the Marvel Universe.
And Stan also continues to play with one of my favorite things that he does, and that very Twilight Zone method of thinking he has, where you have someone who's so paranoid about this one thing hurting them that they create this other thing that's supposedly so much more powerful and can easily protect them, but in an ironic twist of fate, that thing they created winds up being the actual destructive force that they should have been afraid of all along. Mm-hmm. And that was some smart writing on Stan's part to have the Sentinel AI become self-aware and immediately deduce that the best way to protect humanity would be by conquering it.
You know, you bring up Stan's writing here, and I think that's something we need to kind of touch on very briefly is, I think there's a strong argument to be made here that this little three-part Sentinel story might be Stan's best job of writing that we've seen to this point as part of this project. And here's what
I agree with that.
Here's what I'm basing that off of. Both Fantastic Four and Journey into Mystery, I think we all understand at this point, are very strong collaborations between Stan and Jack Kirby. Same for Stan and Steve Ditko with Amazing Spider-Man and Strange Tales, Doctor Strange, you know, what have you, whatever you want to call it. This here, though, we touched on a few minutes ago how Jack Kirby was only really providing layouts and had kind of moved on to do other projects, you know, spend the bulk of his time on other projects. So it kind of feels here like this might be more 100% Stan, and he leans fully in to this topical stuff. And as a result, this might be the most impressive thing from Stan Lee that I've seen to this point.
I would fully agree with that. And we were talking about, you know, an epic story before. Mm-hmm. To me, this is the most epic story that we've read so far in 65. It seems so, I guess on the surface, it seems like very localized, just small to the X-Men characters. Mm-hmm. But when you think about the worldwide implications of what mm-hmm. this means, like Absolutely. What the characters of the Sentinels means, this is so much bigger than just what's happening to these particular five mutants. Mm-hmm. This is a big one. This is one that sets X-Men continuity going forward. And it has never really wavered from this. Like this is the true moment where it all like solidifies. And on top of that, it's just a damn fine looking issue, group of three issues. Artwork is just, it's pristine. It is, this feels like modern comic storytelling. It's not quite the fully decompressed thing. We're still not quite there, but man, we're getting close. And this is one of those stories that edges right up to it without like fully jumping in. And if I can say, I guess I got an affinity for the big lumbering characters who are not necessarily looked at as necessarily being smart by how they appear. But Beast is my favorite character in this. He's my guy. But to one other subplot that Tim, I know you're gonna you pointed this out, and maybe Todd actually I think mentioned this before. As far as like love triangles go, Cyclops, Jean, and Angel is a better love triangle than Cyclops, Jean, and Wolverine.
Thank you.
I'm already more invested in it than I ever expected I would be, but just reading it, I was like, "This makes so much sense." And
yeah, I'll disagree with that strictly on the basis of like, I can, you know, the Scott and Warren thing to me anyway, based on these early issues, they're different characters. I'm not trying to make it sound like they're the same character by any stretch of an imagination, but they're like apples and oranges. You know, they're two different fruits. Whereas the Wolverine thing is so those two characters, Wolverine and Cyclops, could not be any more different. And I think it's the dichotomy of that. It's the two polar opposites that make that triangle interesting. Whereas because Warren and Cyclops feel so much closer to each other, it's like you don't get as invested in terms of, because either way she goes between Wolverine and Cyclops is going to be a drastic move one way or the other. Whereas this one feels, I don't know, feels less drastic.
Warren is so boring at this point.
Yeah, that's
I felt like he got a lot more to do in this issue, and we get to see a little bit more of his background, and it's like a fuse has been lit, honestly, on his life, because his parents still don't know that he has wings. Mm-hmm. And
he has a good relationship with them, which is unusual for its time.
Very much so. Like I was taken aback by how good his relationship is with his parents, to the point where they completely trust him to know what's best. Like they're in the middle of dinner and he's like, shit, I gotta go. His dad is like, well, you're an adult. You can make that call and I'm not going to question it. And I'm just wondering, you know, there is a moment coming when they discover that their son is a mutant. And if my memory serves correct, they do not react well. So
this is all lip service. Of course they can afford to pay a private investigator to follow Warren around. They don't really. I don't know. I'm speculating here, but I mean, yes, I was kind of taken aback. Like, we trust you, which seemed very out of character from what I was expecting.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, same.
It's like there's more going on there. At least it feels like there's more going on beneath the surface that Warren only thinks his relationship with his parents is solid and strong. But the second something happens, something bad goes wrong, this is going to flip, and it's going to flip hard. And we're going to see Warren dealing with a set of circumstances that he probably never imagined he would.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, it's funny. I'd never thought about X-Men as kind of Stan's baby in a way, in that it's not a huge artistic collaboration the way we think of his other efforts as being. So there may be something to that. The one thing about this story that stands out to me beyond just the whole messaging involved here, the Sentinels turning on their creator does make for some very delicious irony, as Russell pointed out. And yet the Sentinels' first appearance here in these three issues is pretty much their definitive story, even though there is enough fuel, I think, creatively steer these guys through a lot of subsequent returns. It's a thing where conventional wisdom says you want to keep it simple, stick to them as the kind of mutant hunting robots, and do that for their debut, save the twist for another day, right, to freshen things up. But Stan just didn't work that way. He didn't know another day was guaranteed for this book, and he shot his water.
That's a solid point. Go ahead,
as though he was sitting on that last line that the narrator says before the end of 16. If I can pull it up here. He was sitting on that line for the entirety of this three-issue series. I don't know if you guys can see it here, where things turn. What you end up hating and calling out, you know, beware the person who does that, because what they're saying is going to be ultimately more harmful than the elements that he's criticizing. I don't know. That was a bad paraphrasing, but it was almost like he was waiting to get that in and hit you with it. To me, the defining, when I think Sentinels, I think Days of Future Past, but
yes,
I just don't think of that as a Sentinel story. This is a Sentinels story about mutant hysteria in the present day. That's more of a, I don't know, dystopia vision type thing that, yes, while the Sentinels are heavily involved, doesn't feel like they have to be in that, you know?
I'll expose myself as an X-Men novice and say when I think of Sentinels, I think of Night of the Sentinels from the animated series. So, you know, that's the first thing that pops in my head. Well, thanks to those Pizza Hut tapes.
I want Pizza Hut right now.
Pizza Hut X-Men comics, yes.
That was how I was introduced to that show. And the X-Men concept in general was through those Pizza Hut tapes. So
I'm really
every promotion finds its mark in someone, and I am a walking, talking example of that. Between that and the Ultimate Universe, every pitch that Marvel has tried will find someone somewhere.
I'm glad you brought that up, because reading this, I was struck by how much of the first season of X-Men the Animated Series is directly influenced by this three-part story. Mm-hmm. Because as I recall, the season finale actually introduces us to Master Mold, and we get that big showdown between he and Professor Xavier. And I mean, it's so overly dramatic. So as the X-Men animated series tended to be, but just going back and reading this, I love seeing that callback. I love seeing that influence that these comics have had, and that, you know, Master Mold probably should have been saved for a little bit later. Like maybe Stan Lee shouldn't have just jumped straight into his full end game, because as you guys pointed out, where can you really go from there? But nonetheless, still a pretty tremendous and influential story that is felt far beyond just this three-part story.
Yeah.
How about Master Mold as the original genocidal robot before Ultron, right?
Yes, yeah. That and apparently Master Mold is very into hearing people's life story. Because he sits there and says, I kid you not, there's one point as he's got Beast under basically like a sodium pentothal.
Call it hypnosis.
Hypnosis. That's what it was. It was a hypnosis, like the truth serum. He's like, tell me everything about your life. And it's like, he gets interrupted at one point. I don't remember what for, but he's like, all right, you shut up. And he's like, now, Beast, you got your scholarship. What happened next? Like, dear God, really? Mm-hmm. But you know what? Because comics, I stayed fully invested, and the story was not hampered by this at all. It was still a whole hell of a lot of fun.
I gotta say, seeing Master Mold here, seeing his origin, popped me big time, because he was the final boss in one of my favorite video games of all time, X-Men Legends, if any of you guys remember that. So,
oh yeah,
that was a cool
that game.
Yep. So, anything else we want to touch on here from the Uncanny X-Men 14 through 16 before we move on to our final story of this episode?
Nope.
Hearing none, we're going to wrap up this episode where we began it, and that's in the pages of Fantastic Four. And during our discussion of Fantastic Four 36, we talked about Medusa and her introduction into the pages of Fantastic Four. And she, of course, provides the impetus. She is the driving force behind Fantastic Four 44 through 45, which we're only going to talk about 44 and 45 because the rest of this story will play out in 1966. So we're going to cut it off here after these first two issues. But these two issues deal with the introduction of Gorgon into the pages of Fantastic Four, and by proxy, the concept of the Inhumans and the royal family and all of those things that go along with that. So, listen, I think we all have dumped on the Inhumans for what feels like a decade now because of the, you know, reputation, earned or otherwise, of Marvel in recent years attempting to replace the X-Men with the Inhumans. And I think it has earned the Inhumans the ire of many a fanboy across the world. There's no debating that. But I found it somewhat interesting here to get back to the beginning of the Inhumans to see what they were like before this whole, you know, replacement push began. And while the stories were not great, I at least found some of the character designs to be interesting, especially in 45 when we get to see Lockjaw and several other of the Inhuman characters. You know, they at least provide an opportunity for Jack Kirby to be visually interesting, even if the story, honestly, is pretty paint-by-the-numbers to this point. So, Todd, you know, we kind of start with Fantastic Four with you a lot of times. Talk to us about some Inhumans. Are you were you a fan, you know, before the recent decade? And if so, what was it like getting to revisit these early Inhuman stories here?
Todd, since you're the oldest and only old people like Fantastic Four, please start us off with what your generation feels about this book.
Jade. Our old. You're our old.
Yeah, I am.
You are our old.
Our old.
Good call.
So, Madame Medusa. This is a case of Stan filling in the blanks or leaving something open, either out of laziness or just saying, let's see how this crazy redhead with the long hair works out and if people are clamoring for more of her. She turns out she's not a villain at all. Mm-hmm. She's just misunderstood. She's part of this family, and we don't know exactly where they are from just yet. But we also have Horny Dragon Man come in.
That's right. I forgot about Dragon Man.
Dragon Man, we haven't talked about at all. What a great, weird, bizarre character, this gray dragon who walks like a man and wears short pants
to hide his dragon dog.
He's a veritable dragon.
He's modest, you know. Come on.
He's actually called a veritable dragon in the issue. And I thought that was a better name. I was like, can I just call him veritable dragon
veritable
from here
dragon.
Out?
Dragon's
better. He goes after the female characters no matter what. So that kind of is what the character is used for. He has a face turn later in the comics, years and years later.
He's got kind of
this constant creature that kind of used however they want.
Kind of a King Kong gimmick, you know, what with protecting the women and stuff. And that's kind of what it felt like to me anyway.
I think he wants to make Dragon Man babies, but that's just me. We got all kinds of stuff going on. Gorgon's this goat character, this thug, tough guy. We've got we see a lot of exposition by Madame Medusa, and they kind of lead them on this quest. But like I was saying, Stan leaves these things to see how they are received, and then he'll fill in the blanks later, or if another idea comes to him. And so here we have Madame Medusa getting out of the Frightful Four and being replaced eventually by, I don't know, who are some of those characters? Thundra. Characters like that, where they had to have a kind of a generic female villain. I don't know about the Inhumans. You know, it's kind of like, stop trying to make Fetch a thing. Stop trying to make the Inhumans a thing. But back then, they were a little bit different, a little bit more offbeat. And the Terrigen Mist, that's kind of like an alternative to, well, I'm going to create these characters without origins. Here you go again. They were really building up towards the reveal of Black Bolt, like he was something really special. Mm-hmm. And although we only get him in one panel because the rest of it takes place in 66, that was kind of the way I was reading it in 65. I'm not 65, I'm sorry, issue 45, mm-hmm. that we're just leading to this point where the big bad reveal and you know, I don't think they were even presenting these guys as anything but misunderstood bad guys, mm-hmm. and they could really go either way at this point. We don't know that they're going to be used as heroes or anti-heroes or what at this point.
One other character that we didn't call out that I feel like we should probably touch on a little bit here is we get the introduction of Crystal, who has kind of always been, you know, for better or for worse, the defining love interest for Johnny Storm, I would argue, based on my knowledge of the Fantastic Four anyway. And so we kind of get to see the very early stages of that dynamic, and we of course know that it will build over the decades, honestly, to come. Tim, what about you? How did this Inhumans origin play for you?
It's sort of hard to comment on these two issues because they're really just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, exactly.
Meeting the Inhumans. I mean, Black Bolt appears in literally the last panel of 45, and this story is going to continue into the year 1966 mm-hmm. for a kind of long stretch of issues, in fact. So I sort of don't want to say too much at this stage, other than I will note that I'm not sure Dragon Man is necessary to these proceedings. While he is pretty cool, it feels a bit like overbooking, you know? Mm-hmm. What's he really doing here? What's he really adding? How does he fit with the story that's taking shape? Funny bit and issue 44 in the opening pages where evidently Reed Richards invents the modern dishwasher.
Yep. And Sue's wearing a hell of a house dress.
My goodness, she sure is. April. So in wedded bliss here. I don't know if it's the honeymoon over or what.
You get the impression that Reed is just getting it in daily at this point. I mean, they are still in the early stages, and he is full of himself, and she is full of him.
Right. Well,
Johnny Storm and the Thing have had enough of this.
They are like, oh, yeah. Good They're God. They've been hearing the noises at night, man. They can feel the walls shake. You know, Reed, when he loses control, parts of his body start to run out to the hallway. He's just, they are done, man. They're like, get me out of here. And Johnny Storm, especially, is like, dude, that's my sister, man. Come on.
Well, he's like, what a boner I committed by not enrolling in college now. Yeah.
What a boner.
Waiting for these two to find their own apartment. They're here every day, every night. Oh, my God.
Especially every night.
Every night.
And Johnny Storm, you called out, Nick, that Crystal is kind of known as his main love interest. And that's probably the only thing saving his reputation with me right now because, well, he's also got a reputation of being a bit of a dog. And he's kind of earning it here because he had a girlfriend at the time.
Mm-hmm. What's her name? Dottie?
Yeah.
Dory.
Dory, excuse me. He did Dory also, dirty.
Yeah, and he's looking over at Crystal. Like, she's just this random chick sitting in an alley. He's just like, Who does Crystal resemble?
Crystal looks like somebody we've seen in the Fantastic Four before this point.
A little bit like Sue Storm, if we're being honest.
Yeah.
I was going more towards Alicia. Alicia Mills.
But that's totally a thing that Johnny Storm is doing. And I was like, you know what, Johnny, you're kind of an asshole right now. But, you know, that's going to wind up being the girl that you wind up with. So I guess I got to give you a little bit of a pass. But man, he's earning that dog reputation pretty early on in Fantastic Four.
Yeah.
18-year-old kids with self-esteem are that way, Russell. They just are.
They truly are.
So, question, where do we stand on what's the deal with Crystal's hair? Is that pattern in her hair like her natural hair color, or is that a thing that an object that she has in her hair?
I have no idea.
Well, we don't even see it yet. We don't see the
I guess we don't.
Band. I think that's the Stan saying, Jack, you got to draw it different so that people don't think she's Alicia.
Yeah.
I think it's just her hair coloration. It's a mutation after the Terrigen Mists, but it's not really normal.
That's how we saw it in the Great Inhumans series on ABC.
Exactly. So,
you know, I've never been really clear on what the official stance was, but anyway, we'll get more into that, I'm sure.
Yeah, and you know, Tim, you bring up a good point that it's hard to talk about the story too much because we have to see the conclusion in 1966 when we get there. The only other thing I can think of that's worthy of comment is, man, they really put Gorgon over as just a physical badass, you know, a threat on the level of the Hulk, but with leveling city blocks and stuff. They are doing their best to get him over from the jump, giving him the Brock push out of the gate, it feels like.
That is very true. He feels almost overpowered compared mm-hmm. to the character as we'll come to know him. But, yeah, it's kind of establishing that these guys are no pushovers, just this one member of the group that will come to be known as the Inhumans, and the Inhuman royal family is giving the entire team a run for their money big time.
All right, well, unless you guys have anything else to add about the Inhumans here in 44 and 45, let's put a pin in this discussion for now. We will, of course... Go ahead, Russell, yes?
I was just going to say, poor man's X-Men. That's my impression of them thus far. And although the more Lockjaw I get, the better, although it's still bugging me because we don't have an origin for him. He's just there, and he's this adorable giant bulldog. But as he is part of the Inhumans, and we know how they're made, I'm asking the question, was he always a dog, or was there a time when Lockjaw was a person?
Depends on the writer, you know, and the editors at that point, I think.
Because I struggle with that for a minute. Because that
they are
really...
called the Inhumans, so exactly. You are led to wonder. Yeah,
I am. I'm like, what was he? But yeah, I'm kind of down with seeing the beginning of Black Bolt. I think that maybe this will finally land, like maybe this three-parter will land in the ending, but these first two parts, I am in full meh mode over it so far.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all kind of in a similar spot, at least as it relates to these characters. I still think some of the visual designs that Kirby brought to it are at least somewhat interesting.
Oh.
But
oh, it's... the best, I will say, I think it might be the best looking issue of that Kirby's drawn so far, Fantastic Four.
And Joe Sinnott, again, is the inker, and everything, there's much more detail on this than any of the other things. This is very definitive.
Yeah, that's probably where the credit really needs to go is Joe Sinnott, not so much Kirby, but as a team, as a duo, they're great together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Jolton,
my favorite.
Joe Sinnott, right?
Yep. Favorite anchor on Kirby stuff.
Awesome. Well, guys, that about does it for our reading list here for the first part of 1965. If you've listened to our episodes previously, you know that we typically will end each episode prior to this with year-end awards, issues of the years, writers of the year, artists of the year. But we're not going to do that because we have another part of 1965 to discuss. So, guys, fellow panel members, keep these issues in mind for when we do our year-end awards at the end of our next episode. And just to give you a little taste of what we'll be covering in 1965 Part 2, we will be looking at the Avengers revamp of their lineup in Avengers 16, some more Green Goblin, as well as Peter's high school graduation in Amazing Spider-Man 26 through 28, the big Thor versus Hercules throwdown in Journey into Mystery Annual Number 1, and then a big old run of Strange Tales that will feature not just Doctor Strange, but also the beginning of Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. So we'll have all that coming up for you next time out on Marvel Age, covering again the second part of 1965. So with that brings our episode to a close. But before we go, let's give our panel members an opportunity to tell you where you can find us and what else we have going on out there in the Place to Be Nation landscape. Mr. Todd Weber, the manager, let's start with you, sir. How can people get in touch with you, and what else do you have going on right now?
Friend me on Facebook. I don't turn anybody down unless you're really weird. Join the Place to Be Nation comics page on Facebook, and we will talk. Mm-hmm. We will talk about these episodes. We will talk about the things that we've talked about on Marvel Age. Also follow me on Twitter. I'm at Todd Weber Guitar. And you just heard me on Marvel Age Masterclass, where I got to listen to Ben Morris talk a lot about people he knows in comics and go through all of 1964, our previous episode, where he kind of dissected the things that we talked about and brought his own perspective. So it was a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Russell Sellers, where can people find you on social media? What do you have going on out there at Place to Be Nation right now?
Well, you can find me on social media at Twitter. On Twitter, you can find me at Russell_Sellers. Yeah, hit the old follow button. Let me know what you thought of all this Marvel Age and the one appearance I've had so far on Marvel Age Masterclass back in its first episode. Mm-hmm. I love talking comics, talking music, movies, everything. I'm a geek all the way through. The next time you'll hear me in kind of a solo podcasting arena probably won't be until closer to the fall, whenever I guess. Can I announce what I'm doing next now?
If you want to, man, it's your your prerogative.
All right. Well, what I'm doing next is a DC focused series of podcasts, series of monthly podcasts that I have kind of dubbed post-crisis management, where I will be taking a look at, along with a different guest each episode, at the different crisis level events within DC Comics. And that will run starting from Crisis on Infinite Earths. And if all publishing goes as it should, we'll end with Heroes in Crisis's final issue in March. So that's going to be the next big project for me, and will lead into a another thing that'll be coming up next year. But you can also find me on a couple of other podcasts throughout Place to Be Nation Pop, and of course, along with everybody else, lurking on the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook group. So hop on over. Would love to talk comics with anyone and everyone.
Tim Capel, what about you, sir? Where can people find you on social media, and what do you have going on? You, sir, are the village bicycle of this particular panel. So why don't you tell us all the numerous irons you have in the fire?
That's right. Ride me until my wheels fall off. Social media wise, I am on Twitter at Cyke68. That's CYKE68. Although I think I'm going to have to change that now that it's been decreed that every Twitter handle with numbers in it is a Russian fucking bot. So we may have to do something about that. But no matter, that's Twitter. Podcast. What the fuck am I doing with podcasts? Place to Be Nation Wrestling, survey says, a WCW retrospective. Myself and Andy Helene, we will have our 15th episode out sometime, I would say, first half of July. So look for that on Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed if you are so inclined. On Place to Be Nation, boop, I have sort of the talk show of Place to Be Nation, but myself and Jennifer Smith, Talking Pop. We had to push our scheduled June episode out a couple of weeks due to various reasons that disappointed both of us and certainly were not our preference, but we're getting back on track, back on schedule with that, and we'll have an episode coming out last week of June, first week of July, somewhere in around there. So look for that on the BUP feed.
Outstanding. I, of course, can be found on social media on Twitter at NickDuke87. I'm also on Facebook, as much as these guys are, on the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. You know, reach out to any of us if you want to get the link to these reading lists so you can read along. Actually, guys, may not be a bad idea to go ahead and pin that at the top of the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page, at least for the time being, until everybody has that as we work through these early episodes. But you can, of course, hear me over also on Place to Be Nation Pop on the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation, The Hard Traveling Fanboys. We just dropped a brand new episode featuring the lovely and so intelligent Mr. Ben Morse talking about our favorite dads in comics. And we will, of course, be bringing you probably very shortly after you hear this podcast, we'll probably have our next episode out, which will be a long book hunt on Ed Brubaker's Daredevil, The Devil in Cell Block D collected story. So going to be taking a look at that. And then we are turning over the month of July to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the seminal comic book film, The Dark Knight, with Dark Knight Trilogy Month, where we will take a look back at Chris Nolan's entire Batman trilogy with a variety of themed shows to celebrate that. So that's where all you can find me. So with all that being said, from myself, from the rest of the Sarcastic Four, we thank you for listening, and we ask that you stay tuned for the second part of 1965. Nuff said.